Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Today, we are heading into the inky darkness of the history of maritime special operations, or special maritime operations, or special operations maritime. Well, you get the picture. We're talking clandestine, amphibious, specialised, elite, independent, subtle, and above all, eye-wateringly courageous ocean and river-based operations in the Second World War. It's the history of the SBS, the Special Boat Service. To find out more, I spoke with the military historian Saul David, author of numerous fabulous books on the military past, and whose most recent book is on, you guessed it, the SBS, and it is called, you guessed it, SBS, though it does have the subtitle Silent Warriors. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoy talking with him, a long-time companion of mine in the world of public history, a born entertainer with an eye for a story. Here is the incisive, the charming, a true historical performer. Here is Saul. Saul, thank you very much indeed for talking with me today.
Thanks, Sam. Delighted to be on.
So why the SBS? Why did you suddenly alight on this wonderful topic?
Very fortuitous circumstances. I've noticed, Sam, that some of the big breaks in my life in terms of subject matter, the odd TV documentary, have come about due to someone else's misfortune. I should really be chuckling because rather wonderful character and former SBS man, and that of course is Paddy Ashdown, had been working on this project. And the fact that he is former SBS himself, he'd served in the 60s, is relevant because the SBS are a very secretive organization, much more secretive than the better known SAS, the SBS of course being the sort of maritime equivalent. And they had authorized the book that Paddy was going to write, and tragically he died in midstream. So the question was, who's going to take it on? And it was, I suppose I was in the very fortunate position of not only being agented by the same person as Paddy, but also in the same publishing house. And I think they felt that I might be an obvious choice and a relatively safe pair of hands. But it wasn't quite that simple, because I then had to go on quite a lengthy vetting process with the Special Boat Service itself, which is a rather trickier hurdle to overcome. But I got there in the end.
They don't let anyone write about their history. Is that the problem?
Yeah, it is the problem. I think, you know, there was a feeling, I think, among the service and among the association, which of course looks after its heritage, that now was probably the time to change. But they wanted to do it in a safe way, and they wanted it, to be done by a safe pair of hands. And of course, an insider like Paddy, who'd written about some of the operations already, probably the best known one is Operation Frankton, and that's the Bordeaux operation, was, you know, their first choice. But Paddy was no longer available, but they still wanted the project done. I think generally speaking, the SBS feel that I mean, they're very proud of their history, but they're also wary that if books like this are written, this may trigger a kind of cascade of former operators writing their own thing. So they've always been very wary, too wary in my view, because, and the MOD too, it won't let anyone officially write about special forces operations after 1948, which is pretty ridiculous in my view. I mean, even some of the Secret Services have been allowing material later than that. So it seems unduly cautious in my view, but that's their position.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't make you join so that you'd be one of them.
Well, they sort of did in the sense that, I mean, certainly I was I was taken down to pool or invited to pool a couple of times. On one particular occasion, they got me in the water. You know, I went out in what is the equivalent of a foal boat or a canoe. So they were very much trying to give me a kind of, I don't know, window into how they work. And actually what was very useful for me to get a sense of the ethos and how the ethos still remains to this day. And it's very under the radar. Their missions are have a purpose, of course, but they're not to go in and kill and cause mayhem. They're usually to go in and surgically take out a target. And hopefully with all the operators getting away afterwards. So they operate in a very different way to the SAS and always did, even from these early years in the Second World War.
It's interesting you were saying that, you know, it's important getting their backing, and that's not a matter of principle because they literally guard their own archives. So it's not as if you could have written the book anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are two important things. I mean, the archive was crucial, of course, for obvious reasons, but in some ways there wasn't as much material, Sam, in that archive as I was hoping for. But nevertheless, there was enough crucial material. But more importantly than that, I think, to get a proper understanding of the organization, which is, you know, as we both know, very shadowy, very sort of closely guarded. It meant that it was important that they open their doors. Of course, to write an authorized book brings its own problems because you feel as a historian co-opted to a certain extent. I mean, it's not an official history, but authorized does mean that you've been welcomed into the fold to a certain extent. And I think even if it's unconsciously, you feel a kind of, you know, a need to do, you know, to do good by that organization. And you have to be wary about that sort of unconscious bias, as we might call it.
Yeah, very tricky. Did you get to interview people and talk to people as well as read documents?
I did, but sadly, there's only one single, he died very recently, one single member of the wartime SBS still alive when I started work on this in 2019. And that was a man called Jim Booth, who took part in one of the most extraordinary operations of the war, and that's Operation Gambit, which was the D-Day midget submarine mission. You know, what is even more amazing, not only, of course, did I have a chance to speak to Jim, he was 99 at the time and eventually got to his 100th birthday and only died in 2022. But also, he provided me with a little bit of footage of the midget submarine operation, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the only piece of footage of special forces in the Second World War. And it's extraordinary. It's as the submarine is coming back from the beaches, where it's played an absolutely vital role in marking Sword Beach, and it's going back to the command ship. And you can see Jim Booth in this piece of footage standing on the top of this tiny submarine. I mean, it's a remarkable piece of Second World War footage, as I say.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting place to start with D-Day. Let's do that. I mean, what do you mean by marking Sword Beach? Why were the SBS important on D-Day?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the sort of great unknown stories of the Second World War. It's not that it'd never been written about before, Sam, but as you know, a lot of history falls through the cracks, not because it's not included in some obscure book somewhere, but because it hasn't really entered the public consciousness. And I think the role of the SBS on D-Day was absolutely vital. They do three things, really, that are noteworthy. First of all, they carry out the beach reconnaissance prior to D-Day, which is absolutely vital to getting all that information about the sort of type of sand, whether it can bear tanks and wheeled vehicles, but also the gradients coming up to the beach. I mean, when you're going to carry out an amphibious operation, you need all this vital hydrographical information. You also need information about the defences on a beach and the exits from the beach. And the SBS carry out all these vital reconnaissance missions by swimming to shore, incredibly dangerous operations. Some of the swimming was done from midget submarines and some from surface craft. And they brought back this cornucopia of information, which enabled the planners, and we're talking 6 months before D-Day, to put in place, and to refine their plans. And one really key bit of the story is that when they discovered the strength of the defenses on Omaha Beach, and this was in January 1944, it encouraged the Allied High Command to increase the number of landing beaches from 3 to 5. I mean, it's the well-known story that there were originally just 3, and people like Montgomery were pushing to increase the numbers, but the key bit of information came from the SBS, and they said to the Americans, look, it's going to be a really tough nut to crack. So from that point onward, the Americans went from 1 beach, which was Omaha, to 2 with Utah.
Yeah. So a fairly sophisticated operation here at the end of the war. Let's rewind and go back to the beginning and look at the origins of the SBS. Where did it come from?
Well, it came from this amazing character called Roger Courtney, who, had really been a kind of adventurer. He wasn't a soldier, wasn't a military man at all. He'd done a bit of TA work. He'd been a part-time soldier in the early 1920s. But he'd always wanted to go to Africa. He gave up his job working in a bank in Leeds, and he headed off to Africa with £50 in his pocket, which was not nothing, but eventually it was going to run out. And he spent the next 20 years effectively as an explorer, gold prospector. And here's the really key bit. He, as an adventurer and as an explorer, he decided to paddle in a folding canoe known as a Folbot, which he'd bought from Selfridges, down the, I know, you couldn't make it up, down the White Nile River alone. So many moments during that, which he later wrote about, actually, in a book that was quite a successful book. But what this enabled him to realize is that a Folbot, a canoe in effect, was a perfect means of insertion for silent insertion at night for enemy shorelines. I mean, he could see the, and also he became expert in its use, so that when he joined the commandos in 1940 at the outset of the war, he quickly suggested, the commandos of course were set up by Churchill as a raiding force for enemy coastlines, but Courtney refined that further by saying, look, if we create a new unit as part of the commandos initially, which uses canoes as a form of insertion, we can do what the commanders aren't intending to do. They're going to go, a lot of them are going to go in, there's going to be a lot of bang bang and explosions, but we can go in silently and we can carry out missions that they would never be able to dream of, and we can do it and get away without the enemy knowing we've been there. And the Navy aren't entirely convinced about this. They were in charge of training up in Inveraray in Scotland, so they set him a test. Can he actually approach a command ship, one of their assault ships, even though the sentries are looking out for him, and effectively blow up the ship by marking chalk on the outside of the hull where the Limpet mines would be, and even get on board and take away a gun cover to prove he'd been there. And that's exactly what he did. And they were astonished.
Wow.
And they thought, for goodness sake, the guys are all ready for you, and they didn't notice you coming. You got on board, and all of a sudden they could see the stealth that was possible by using canoes. There are drawbacks with canoes, of course, Sam, which is that in high seas, when you're operating in the sea, as soon as the wind gets up about 4 knots and the waters get choppy, they can be very unstable and quite dangerous, frankly. But nevertheless, properly trained, they began to see the possibility. So they allowed him to set up what was known as the Folbot troop, just 12 strong to begin with, and this eventually becomes the special boat section. And then it develops in lots of different ways and lots of different tentacles. One of the tricky things about the book actually was trying to make sense of all the different and interlocking bits of the story, because it's not just Courtney and his SBS. There's also something called COP, Combined Operations Pilotage Party, set up by a guy who was a close colleague of Courtney's, a man called Lieutenant Commander Wilmot, who's another of the big heroes of the story. And there was also the third strand, which was the RMBPD, the so-called Cockleshell Heroes. And that was set up by Blondie Hasler. So you've got these three big giants of the story, Courtney.
That's Wilmot. The Royal Marine Boom Patrol Detachment,
exactly,
is that correct?
Exactly. You've You've got to have a stomach for acronyms when you're working on the special forces in the Second World War, because they, and a lot of the acronyms, of course, including the one you've just mentioned, RMBPD, were used to put the enemy off what the real intention of these units was. So they were never, you know, specific to their task, but they were kind of alluded to. The attempt was made to make them seem far more benign and you know, incompetent than they actually were.
So there was such a wonderful story, but my favourite bit about that was Selfridges, and it makes me wonder what it would have been like there. Do you reckon there was a... Well, I think there are three options. One is that there was a folding canoe department. Two, that there was some kind of implausible adventuring department, or maybe even specifically a White Nile department. What's going on there?
Well, definitely, I think the sporting department. I think the point to make about the folding boats is, of course, they were eventually used, as we are discussing, for serious military purposes in the Second World War. But they were very popular among canoe clubs, basically, particularly in Germany, actually. But also these began to gain some ground in the UK as well. So Selfridges was providing a kind of civilian sporting kit, really. So it would have been their sporting department. But it is fascinating. In the archives at Poole in Dorset, the SBS archives, you can still see the original docket from the shop that he paid for. And I think it was something like £22, which is not an inconsiderable amount, actually.
Yeah, it just makes me think of people wandering around Oxford Street with loads of weird stuff coming out of Selfridges. Anyway, it does lead us on to a kind of a more broad question about the kit, kind of specialised kit that they use. You mentioned limpet mines. So we've got, folding kayaks, limpet mines. What else was involved?
Well, I mean, the first and most important point to make is that at the beginning, there was no specialist kit at all. I mean, they were just making it up as they went along. So the folding boat, of course, was a civilian folding boat. It was later developed, actually, in particular by Hasler, and they turned it into something, you know, really quite sophisticated with, you know, what you might recognize, I suppose, a modern kayaker or canoe, which is the, you know, the kind of splash deck and the forms of stabilization, which made these boats a little bit more stable in choppy waters. But the other crucial things that the SBS needed, of course, were particularly when they got in the water. So in a nutshell, a lot of the missions would be carried out, particularly reconnaissance missions, by two guys. So it would be a two-man canoe. One guy would stay in the canoe while the operation was carried out, and the other guy would get into the water and swim ashore. Now, you know, eventually they got wetsuits, which were reasonably effective, but it took time to develop them. So on one of the first missions, which was carried out by Courtney and Wilmot, very dangerous mission, reconnaissance mission in the Mediterranean. Now, you might think, great, the Mediterranean, the sea would have been quite warm. But of course, the time of the year it took place, which was March 1941, it was absolutely freezing. And at that stage, they were just making things up as they went along. So instead of a wetsuit, which didn't exist at that time, they were just wearing woolly underwear, basically, lined with some kind of grease to try and keep out the cold. And the end result of all of that, of course, is that even though Wilmot was an excellent swimmer, Courtney not so much, Courtney almost drowns on that operation because he gets so cold and he can hardly, you know, find his way back to the canoe. So they were really making things up as they went along, and slowly but surely the equipment got more sophisticated as the war went on. But in the early years, 1940, 1941, 1942, it's incredibly dangerous to carry out these missions because their kit was so threadbare.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Let's talk about a couple of those early operations or sort of follow the history through. Rhodes, why was Rhodes important?
Well, Rhodes was really the testing ground of whether or not you could use canoes to get the sort of information I've been talking about, this beach reconnaissance information. Now, Courtney, of course, had already set up the Folbot troop and he'd gone out with the rest of the commandos in early 1941 to the Mediterranean. And while he was there, he met Wilmot, who completely separately had come up with the idea of beach reconnaissance. Now, Courtney's idea was we're going to do sabotage, we're going to insert enemy agents, there's going to be a lot of other stuff that we can carry out. But Wilmot all along was absolutely convinced, partly because he was the nephew of a man who'd taken place in the Gallipoli landings, that these sorts of amphibious operations would be disastrous unless you had proper information. And the way to get that was actually sending guys in. So he knew what he wanted to get, but he didn't have a method of insertion. And so meeting Courtney was incredibly fortuitous because Courtney told him about the canoes and he thinks, great, we'll be transported in submarines as far as the beaches and then we can paddle in the canoes. It all sounds rather straightforward, but if you consider it was taking place, the Rhodes reconnaissance, which of course was Axis held at the time, and there were plans in place to capture Rhodes by amphibious assault. It never actually took place because of the Greek debacle a few months later, but that's not the point. The point about the reconnaissance is, can we actually show we can get the information that is going to be needed for these types of operations? So the two of them carry out the operation. And if you think about it, you've got these two giants of the story who almost come a cropper. I mean, they almost get bounced by sentries at one point. I've already mentioned the fact that Courtney almost dies of the cold. I mean, it was incredibly dangerous for these two men to carry out this operation with inadequate kit, attempting to home to a submarine in the dark, in freezing temperatures. I mean, a lot could have gone wrong. A lot almost did go wrong. And yet over the course of four nights, they managed to penetrate the Italian defenses at Rhodes and bring back an astonishing amount of information. You can still see the report, which is actually in the National Archives. It's been released in the National Archives today. And it gives you the kind of sense of drama that mission was. But it also convinces everyone in the Middle East, in particular in Cairo, HQ in the Middle East, that actually this is a runner. These guys can really do what they say they can do. So it was proof of concept, I suppose you would say, Sam. And in that sense, it was absolutely vital because once this mission had been carried out, the two guys go their separate ways. Wilmot's eventually going to find COP, which I mentioned before. And of course, Courtney's going to carry on developing the SBS. But they have proven to the higher ups that it really can be done.
Yeah, and so strategically important. I mean, the Italians are using this island to attack Allied shipping, lay mines. You know, it's crucial to everything that goes on. Let's move on to 42. There are a couple of really interesting operations in 1942. Boulogne is one. I like the fascinating story of this.
Yeah, I mean, the Boulogne one has really, again, like a lot of these SBS stories. I don't quite know why, but it's also slipped through the cracks. I mean, we know about other operations, of course, that took place that year. The most famous one was the attempted assault at Dieppe, the disastrous assault at Dieppe, which, by the way, Sam, they use no SBS reconnaissance for. A bit of a mystery, that. But Boulogne takes place a couple of months earlier, and it's an astonishing operation because the channel ports, as Dieppe proved, were probably some of the most heavily guarded installations in Europe at that time. And inside Boulogne Harbour was a tanker filled with copper ore that the British had decided they needed to knock out because these are vital resources for Germany. And the SBS decides to do the mission. A guy called Gerald Montanaro, who for a brief time was second in command of the SBS, very ambitious man, former Royal Engineer, who is an explosive expert, but he also is absolutely determined to get to the top of the special forces tree. He's actually, his way is ultimately barred, of course, by Courtney, who's got there first. But Montanaro's finest hour is this mission at Boulogne, where he volunteers with his paddler, a man called Priest. And together, the two of them are going to carry out the mission. Now, the difficulty you've got in the Channel, as opposed to the Mediterranean for these secret night missions, is that you can't get close to a shoreline with a typical submarine, which is what they'd use for the Rhodes reconnaissance. The weather conditions and the coastline is too difficult to use a big submarine. So you have to use surface craft. And the problem with surface craft is that if it gets too close to the coastline, you can hear it. So basically, you have to paddle a lot further than you would if you'd come in a submarine. And this is where the trouble starts for the Boulogne operation, because they dropped off 3 miles from the shoreline. And by the time they get to Boulogne Harbour, they're utterly exhausted. They then have to get past the fort at the entrance to the harbour, where a party is going on. And they're basically paddling, almost completely lying flat in the canoe. And a beer bottle narrowly misses the boat. I mean, that's how close they came to this German installation. And then real disaster happens, because the Folbrot is snagged on a rock. And it starts leaking. Now, this is now a race against time. Montanaro has to make a decision. What's he going to do? Is he going to abort the mission, which frankly would have been the sensible thing to do? But no, this was his one chance. So he tells Priest to plug the hole with his cap comforter, the sort of woolly commando hat these guys used to wear. And then he breaks the time fuses on the Limpet mines, which means there's no going back now. They're going to explode within a few hours. And they carry out the mission, put 8 Limpet mines onto this tanker. One falls off, but 7 are inserted correctly. And then they've got a home back to this surface craft, which has been told to leave on the dot. And if they get it any later than that, they're going to be abandoned. Well, they're an hour late. And as they're approaching the rendezvous point, which, by the way, they've only got to because of Montanaro's brilliant navigation. I mean, in choppy seas at night. I mean, it's an amazing feat of seamanship, but it's also an extraordinary act of endurance, because by the time they get to the rendezvous point, the canoe is half full of water. And it would probably have sunk, they estimate, in another 10 minutes. And of course, they're in the middle of the channel at this point. So that would have been a death sentence. But incredibly fortuitously, the landing craft has stayed longer than it should have done against its orders. And they're picked up. They're so exhausted, they can't actually get out of the canoe. They're so cold, they have to be lifted out by a winch. But it was an astonishing little operation which succeeded. The tanker explodes and it sinks to the bottom of Boulogne Harbour, losing a lot of its vital kit on board, losing a lot of its copper ore. And the two guys who carried out the mission, they're rewarded with a DSO and a DCM, respectively. And there's a lovely little entry in Montanaro's diary. And he talks about, went on this mission, almost sank, but managed to pull it off, a damn good show. It was just so British and understated.
Yeah, I mean, extraordinary. Seeing their faces when they realised that they'd hung around and they'd managed to pick them up, that must have been wonderful. So we've spoken about Rhodes in the Mediterranean. We've spoken about the Channel and Boulogne. Let's talk about, the final big theatre we haven't really mentioned. What was going on in Sumatra?
Yeah, I mean, the lovely thing about the story is that you might imagine, because it's special boat service or special boat section, as it was known at the time, and, they were operating out of the Mediterranean and then the UK, that it was really just the European theatre of operations. In actual fact, in 1944, Mountbatten, who's now been appointed commander in the Far East, but has always been a big fan of these maritime operations, and he had, of course, been chief of combined operations under which some of these operations were carried out. He sets up a new group in the Far East called the Small Operations Group, and it's based in Ceylon, and it carries out a number of different missions all over the Far East, and some wonderful stories. But my favorite is the Sumatra mission. They're given the job of blowing up the Pudada Bridge. This is Japanese held. It's a sort of vital arterial route. It's a road and rail bridge over the Pudada River in northern Sumatra. And this, again, is going to be a preparatory to a landing on Sumatra, a landing that in this case, of course, never takes place. But that was the intention. And so a team of SBS, four pairs of canoeists in this particular instance are taken across the Bay of Bengal, this incredibly long and uncomfortable journey. And I should just mention, Sam, I don't know if you've ever been in a submarine, but Second World War submarines were incredibly inhospitable places to operate from, and particularly if you're SBS, because you weren't really a specialist, of course, a specialist submariner. You were just being transported, and utterly terrifying when they were being depth charged, but incredibly uncomfortable, difficult journeys they had to undertake. And this was a very long one. Anyway, they close in on the location, and they get to the right place, and they're dropped off four teams of canoeists. But the first night's attempt is an absolute disaster. They basically, an error is made in the navigation. They get to the wrong point. They go up the wrong side of the estuary, heading up towards the bridge, and it's impassable. And eventually they have to call the mission off, and they head back to the submarine, which is, again, always done at night, homing to a submarine, very difficult and dangerous operation to do, with no tangible results. And they are convinced, and you know, not only is this embarrassing humiliation, but they're convinced that, you know, that's it, that's the end of the mission, you can only try it once. But actually they realize that, or at least they make a calculation, that the Japanese almost certainly didn't spot them that first night, and maybe none of the locals did either, and they can give it another go. Now the second night's operation is much more effective, and it's led really by I think the hero of the story, a man called Lieutenant Wesley. Now Wesley's second in command, but he convinces his boss, Major Sidders, that he really needs to take the lead in terms of navigation. He does get them to the right place. They manage to get all the way to the bridge with 400 pounds of explosives, having narrowly avoided detection by a Japanese cycling patrol. But they get to the bridge, and they're putting all the plastic explosives onto the bridge in various key parts of the bridge, when they're spotted by some locals who just appear, you know, as if, you know, now this is the middle of the night, remember, so where these guys come from no one quite knows, but they're corralled under gunpoint just in case one of them decides to run off and tell the Japanese. And once they put all the explosives on the bridge and the time pencils are set, they head back down to the beach, of course, to get back to the canoes. And the idea is, you know, obviously they're going to home to the submarine, but they've still got the locals with them because, again, they don't want them to tell the Japanese. And when they get to the beach, Sidders remembers that he'd been given this instruction. If you find if there are any locals there who you might think can provide vital information, bring them back with you. Now, exactly how they were going to do that is not entirely clear, because there's only room for eight people in these canoes. But anyway, they decide they're going to take one of them back. So maybe they're going to do two trips in a full boat. So they select a young guy who, once he realizes what's about to happen, has absolutely no intention of going and struggles wildly. Wesley's given the job of subduing him. First of all, he tries to punch him, just knock him out. That doesn't work. Then he hits him with his revolver. That doesn't work. And eventually he tries to, as he puts it in his diary, drown some of the life out of him. And this kind of ridiculous wrestling match in the sea, which comes to a conclusion when the Indonesian bites Wesley's hand and forces him to let go of him. And it's at this point that Wesley realizes this is absolute madness. We've got to let this go. So he pats this guy on his back, as he puts it, you know, a poor compensation for all the hardship we put him through. They let him go. They get into the canoes, head back to the submarine. And as they're nearing the submarine, they almost miss it, actually. It almost turns into disaster. They see this kind of red glow on the horizon, and boom, the bridge goes up. So there's a happy ending to the story. But one last codicil to all of that, Sam, is that, you know, I've noticed with special forces operations, they're really sparing at giving out the sort of awards that you might think would be justified. And in this particular case, this extraordinary mission, a single military cross is handed out. Who does it go to? Not to Wesley, not to any of the men who really carried out the key roles in this, but to Major Sidders, who clearly is the man who's put the report in the first place.
What a great story and a brilliant place to end. Saul, thank you very much indeed for sharing so much great history.
Cheers, Sam.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, please don't leave your interaction with our brilliant podcast here. There is so much more you can do. Firstly, please check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast's YouTube channel, where you will find a library of the most extraordinarily innovative videos showcasing the maritime past in entirely new ways. If you are interested in the Second World War, as we were talking about today, please check out our 3D animation of one of the Japanese aircraft carriers that took part in the attack on Pearl Harbor, and our video showing the scan of a wrecked midget submarine on the shore of Aberlady Bay in Scotland. In the audio podcast's back catalogue, make sure you listen to our episode on the shifting balance of naval power during the war with Paul Kennedy. We have an episode on the evacuation of Dunkirk and one on the U-boat war. And in fact, there is so many more I haven't even mentioned. This podcast comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research. Please check out what both institutions are up to. You can find the SNR at snr.org.uk, where you can join up. And please do so. Every single new member makes a difference. It's a wonderful chance to make new friends and to learn about the maritime past from the world's best. And the History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation you can find at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk. And be sure to check out their brilliant new project, filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera equipment. To find it, just Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.